Hello, it's Howard in London at the home of The Unexplained, www.theunexplained.tv. Now, I'm just dropping in here, not with a regular edition of The Unexplained, but with something that featured on my radio show last Sunday night, a special appearance by Paul Sinclair, great friend of this show. He made his first appearance on The Unexplained and is now world famous with his research into weird happenings in the east of Yorkshire, most of which have been chronicled in the Truth Proof books. Paul has a couple of new books coming out. He is very prolific, and he's always a great guest. He was on the radio show last Sunday, and I thought, because people have been asking for this, that you should be able to hear it here too. So, from my radio show last Sunday night, which was the 8th of March, here's Paul Sinclair talking about his latest research. Paul Sinclair in Yorkshire tonight, live to us. Paul, how nice to have you on. Thanks for making time.
Thank you very much, Howard. And as always, great to talk.
Absolutely. Now, Paul, we're gathering listeners all the time. You know, they say a rolling stone gathers no moss. We're gathering listeners all the time. Some of them, not many, though, given the response that I've had on my Facebook page, the official Unexplained with Howard Hughes Facebook page. Check it out. You know, some of them may not be aware of you. So talk to me about you and the research that you're doing there.
Well, I packed in work at the age of 48. I don't know why I'm stressing this, but I need to stress, not because I've loads of money, but I've just got enough to sort of tick along quite comfortably. And since 48, I've been a full-time researcher in the unexplained and or unexplained phenomena, something that's followed me, Howard, throughout my life. So obviously, I don't really think there's been I wouldn't say a waking moment, that'd be an exaggeration, but there's not been a day past where the things of an unexplained nature have not been passing through my mind due to the things that have happened to myself. So it sort of followed on. It's a passion. I'm an avid researcher. I'm up at 5:30 in the morning. I'm sort of gathering notes. I'm just never still. Tonight, I've been on the cliff tops tonight with a very good friend, Dave Barnes, who's travelled a considerable distance with his wife. And me and Dave have been up there hoping to catch a glimpse of this phenomena, this light form phenomena, which Dave actually witnessed the last time he was here. And it's something that we've noted when people who've never been to these cliff tops before, they seem to have an experience. I don't mean every time, but I have noted that odd times, Howard, when I take somebody up who's new, something happened or happens. And, you know, it just never switches off. And my phone's going now.
Well, maybe you can switch that off. But you know, let's talk about the area then, because the cliffs that you talk about are the cliffs that we've talked about many times on the podcast that you and I have done. And you've written about extensively in the Truth Proof books. These are the cliffs at Bempton. This whole area, it's all the way down from like Scarborough Filey, that way, isn't it? Down towards, probably down as far as Hull and Grimsby, and then inland to, do you go as far as Fylingdales? I don't think you go quite that far, do you?
It does. It encompasses a fair area. It's like a huge chunk of land. I mean, Bempton's not the all-encompassing part. But if we stuck a pin in a map and started there and went with a 30-mile radius out at sea and inland, we'd be just about hitting it. And
so geographically, I remember in the old days, because I'm sad like this, Yorkshire Television, great company that sadly no longer exists, had a transmitter in Scarborough. And the coverage area of that transmitter is roughly the area we're going to be talking about tonight, if that helps at all.
Yeah, and it's not just UFO-type phenomena that's been reported. I mean, there's some things, Howard, that I think I've previously said that I never thought I'd even be looking into, and that's the cryptid sightings. And you're getting people from all walks of life, you know, academics and building trade workers. It doesn't discriminate. People are seeing these things and reporting them. And either everybody's sorry about this. I'm going to move the phone. One second.
You see, it's such demand. It's probably some international media organization. See, Paul and I first spoke, I think it was probably 3 or 4 years ago, probably three. And we talked about the first Truth Proof book that I've had a certain amount of involvement in over the years. Very proud of Paul. He's a proper nuts and bolts grassroots researcher who gets out there and checks out things for himself. So we've spoken for that long, and now he gets media requests from around the world all the time. And that was probably one of them. Are you back?
I'm back, and I do apologize.
Of course, all right. Yeah. No worries. So, you know, we're talking...
I've been doing a bit of work, not work as such. Well, that's what it is. I've had some lengthy conversations with the guys at Ancient Aliens, and they've been wanting to pick my brains on the stories of the Flixton Werewolf and the accounts of the cryptids around Eastern North Yorkshire. And, you know, it's just grown from strength to strength. And as, like I said previously, these cryptid-type sightings are things that I never thought I would look into. But I think we've got to look at them seriously. If we've got so many people unconnected to one another coming forward and reporting these things, and it's not just once a year or twice a year, it's almost like it's a snowball that's gathering pace, and the more that people are realizing that others are opening up and saying they've seen these things, the more reports are coming in. It's quite incredible, really.
And it's more than just the occasional animal mutilation. These are very strange occurrences that have happened multiple times and have really worried the farmers in that area. And I know that most of those people want to remain anonymous when you quote them in the book. But we're talking about bloodless animal mutilations of the kind that are found in America and other parts of the world. And they're not the kind of thing that could be done by some kind of random, I don't know, fox or something like that, because of the way that the animals that you discover, and you keep discovering, the way that they are torn apart. Well, they're not torn apart. That's the point. They are scythed apart in a very surgical way, in a bloodless way. And sometimes things are taken from these carcasses that you wouldn't expect to be taken, like tongues, for example. It is weird.
That's correct. One part of the phenomena contradicts another, because you look at the reports of the cryptids and the werewolf type reports, which most people just think exist in horror films and you know, strange movies. And you'd think if a creature like that was responsible for the deaths of these unfortunate animals, then we would be looking at carnage. We'd be looking at something torn to pieces. And I'm sorry to sound macabre, listeners, but in a lot of instances, particularly in 2017 through to the early 2019, the livestock, primarily sheep, they were having their ears sliced off and their eyes removed and the faces stripped of skin, with very little else done to them. In some cases, the throats. It does sound...
Well, macabre. We just have to say that, I mean, it is very late at night, and I think people do know what to expect from this program, but if you are of a sensitive disposition, rather like my technical producer, Sarah, now, who's got her head in her hands, then some of these details may be a little difficult for you to stomach, and you may want to go make a cup of Earl Grey tea or whatever you do at this time and come back in about 10 minutes. But no, they are astonishing because they look as if they're something that's been done by somebody doing a post-mortem.
You can't imagine how a sheep, which we've said before is a sort of dirty white colour when it's roaming free in the field, could sustain such injuries as having its throat removed and not being blood on the carcass or the trauma around the eye. There's just a clean hole where the eye was. Now, for the people that want to say, oh, well, crows will have done that first thing in the morning. I walked these fields, listeners, at 4:30 and 5:30 in the morning, finding these carcasses before predation could take place. That was the difference before I became alerted to this. The farmer was finding these carcasses decimated by fox and badger.
You were finding these when they were fresh kills.
Fresh kills in some instances, and there were strange things happening as well. I would walk this particular area and do a grid section of the field, and one particular morning I did this and then went into a section of woodland where I were finding deer carcasses, and lots of the times with the deer carcass they were having sections of the liver removed. The badgers were being skinned. I was finding badgers, and the badgers were being skinned. If listeners could imagine having a pair of fur trousers on and the rest of your skin removed from the waist up, that's how the badgers were being skinned.
And what makes it weirder, and the last time we talked on my podcast was in January, and once again we remarked on the fact that these animal mutilations were happening in this very surgical and precise way, but you would need a lot of equipment to do that, all of these. And yet there are few, if any, signs of anything having entered the particular area of wild country or farmland. No signs of, what do they call it, access and egress. No signs of somebody or something going there and making a trail out.
This is correct, and it's so remote. And I challenge anyone to try and catch a sheep. I'm being serious. I mean, they don't want to be caught. So imagine this thing, this predator, we call it whatever you want to call it, was preying on roe deer as well, which must be one of the fastest animals that we've got in the UK. And once again, the main sort of injuries were eyes removed, muzzle area stripped of skin, and if the internal organs had been opened up, parts of the liver removed. And that seemed to be the pattern that was happening. No prime cut pieces of meat, which a predator would want, were being taken.
Which is bizarre, isn't it? You know, if it was something that was killing to eat, then, of course, it wouldn't do it in such a surgical way. And it would take whatever it needed to eat, and that would be the end of the story. And it would leave a trail, presumably, and there would be blood around the place. I'm sorry if these details are gruesome. Please, as I say, exercise listener discretion and go make a cup of tea if, you know, these few details we're going to give you are too much. But I think it's to be expected when we talk about these things. And what we have to say, Paul, is that it's not just a few isolated cases. This is still going on. It's going on right now.
Well, in the end, what we'll call the affected area, the livestock, the sheep have been removed, but it's not stopped the deer being killed. You know, wild roe deer. So that's still happening. And I need to stress that whatever this intelligence is that's responsible, and you know, we can't rule out humans. I don't personally believe it's human intervention. I've no proof that it's anything else, but everything points to it being something other. But whatever it is, it's also got the ability, or had the ability when it was at the height of the killing, to take out harbour porpoise, the small dolphin about 3 or 4 foot long. And they were being found on the cliffs and on the beaches below and in very close proximity to where the livestock, the sheep and the deer were being killed.
But so are we saying that whatever phenomenon this might be is also seaborne?
I believe it's airborne, land-based and seaborne. And it might be too much for some people to take on board. But when you were finding, primarily the rock anglers were pointing these things out to me, and I've been and looked at them. And when you're finding porpoise that look absolutely pristine and intact, barring a large hole through their jaws, you're thinking, what could have done this? And it's happening at the same, all these killings were happening at around at the same time. We're not seeing the extent of it now because, as I say, the livestock has been removed. He's not said the reason, but I'm suspecting the reason. I mean, when you've lost going on over 50 sheep, you're not going to risk any more, are you? It's quite a lot of money for a farmer to take a hit for
him. And I'm guessing the poor farmers who've borne the brunt of some of this, they can't be insured for this kind of thing. How would you declare that on an insurance form?
It must be difficult. And anyone that wonders if the police have been involved, in the early stages they were, but they drew a blank. That's why I found out about it initially, because of a chap who lives in the dyke, Danes Dyke, the woodland. The police had visited him, and mainly to ask him if he'd seen any unusual looking animals, in particular a very unusual looking dog. And that's what they told him. And from that, I found out and did a bit of digging and found out where the farm was, found out the farmer, and went from there. I wasn't looking for unexplained phenomena as such. At first, I rang all the livestock auctions in eastern North Yorkshire. I wanted to find out if other livestock were being killed anywhere else. And as it happened, up at Ravenscar, which would probably be 30 to 40 miles up the coast, but on the coast, once again, on the edge of the North Sea, sheep were being killed in a similar manner there. Further down the coast towards Sproatley, which is the other way, sheep were being killed there. Now, I've not spoken to the farmers, but I've spoken to farmers who know those farmers, and I'm not keen on second-hand information, Howard, as you know, but I've got it on good authority that they were being killed at Sproatley. But the farmers I dealt with around eastern North Yorkshire, around the Bempton and Filey area, I've spoke to direct and sort of face-to-face, and over a long period of time, these animals were being killed, and it was me that was finding them. I mean, I had a little bit of, I wouldn't say abuse, but a bit of a backlash around the villagers because people were saying, who is this guy? He's talking about these things, not necessarily the macabre killings.
Right, and that's what I was going to get you to, that people had come to accept, if you can, this as being something that happened and maybe something that they didn't particularly want to talk about. One thing I've never asked you, and I should have, in all the conversations we've had, I'm aware of the period of research that you've done, but have you got a sense of how long that stuff was going on for? Has it been going on for, you know, a decade, more?
From what I can gather in what we'll call the affected area, and I think it started in mid-2016 and ended when the livestock left, which is not long since. We're only talking 6 months since. And it's still happening in that woodland with the roe deer. But I know because I found them, and there's another chap in Bempton found one with the ears removed and brought it to my attention, and we went and photographed the unfortunate animal. I mean, we can't attribute everything to true unexplained phenomena, Howard, but there's something very strange happening in this area. It just can't be denied.
Now, you know that in your own area and also in various parts of the country, earlier in this show we talked with somebody in Somerset, but it's happening Beds, Hearts and Bucks, Gloucestershire, Yorkshire, Cornwall, you know, hot spots all over the country. People are seeing what they think are big cats. Do you think, or have you been able to rule out the possibility that a big cat might have been behind some of this? I don't know how a big cat would get out to sea and deal with a porpoise in the way that it did, but have you considered that?
We've considered the big cats because, not for the livestock killings, but simply because they are in the area. And there's too many people seeing them. I think it was last year at the pond at Buckton. I know a lot of listeners won't be familiar where this is, but it's close to Bempton and Bridlington, if you want to Google these locations. And that made the newspapers, and there was a cat seen by about five independent witnesses at various times, just over a few days. And what's interesting, Howard, about these cat sightings, and particularly, usually it's a black cat, they're showing up in the same locations, but there's years in between. And short lane between Bempton and Bridlington, which is just an unassuming lane with no trees, it's just got fields either side of it, and we've got big cat sightings. And I think I might be repeating myself here, but we've also got, it from 2006, I think it was, the Bridlington Free Press article, Hunt for the Deer Butcherers. And they found deer carcasses on Short Lane. And they said the meat had been pared off the bone in an unusual manner by poachers. But unusually, the meat hadn't been taken. Mm. It sort of contradicted itself.
And what kind of poacher obviously would operate like that? We're talking about high strangeness in East Yorkshire with the man who's an expert on all of this. We're learning more about it all the time, so is he, Paul Sinclair, author of the great Truth Proof books. Check them out online because they are well worth seeing. Back to Paul Sinclair. So Paul, if it's okay with you, I would like to get an update on the strange lights, because you and I have spent several years talking about these weird lights in that Bempton area, and the last time we spoke on the podcast in January, the lights behaved more weirdly than I've ever heard you talk about them.
That's correct. And it's almost as though this phenomena, whatever it is playing with us. It genuinely is. I mean, I went up there tonight with Dave, and I'm spending an unhealthy amount of time up there hoping to catch sight of them, but they don't play the game. It's almost when we take new people up that things happen. On February the 11th and the 12th, Chris Turner came, the documentary filmmaker, to start filming on our new documentary. And he brought a guy with him called Jerry Denning, a lighting and sound engineer, really nice guy. And we went up onto the cliff tops during the evening after we'd sort of filmed these witnesses to different various sightings. And I don't know, we were interviewing a guy called Lee Haywood. We'd set some lights up, it had gone dark, and trying to get the atmosphere about some lights, some strange lights that he'd seen with me a few months previous, and they really blew Lee away. And Lee's switched on to most things. He checks everything out in detail. So he basically came up, Howard, to squash the idea of unexplained phenomena and went away with more questions than answers. But to get back to it, we received a phone call whilst there from a guy called Chris Wright and his friend, I can't remember his friend's name, Stephen Jackson. They were in Scarborough to inform us that they'd just seen a triangle of orange lights somewhere down the coast over Bempton and Flamborough. Well, we'd not seen it, even though we were there, probably because we'd got the lights on and the glare and we were talking to Lee. After that, we received another call from a guy called Mark. The name slips me, but he'd also seen these lights. And basically, on the strength of what they'd said, and we told him Chris Turner was up here and we were doing this film, these two guys from Scarborough came through. And they arrived about 7:30, and at 8 o'clock, a large orange sphere appeared over the sea. Now, I need to describe to people that these things don't fly from anywhere. This is on the 12th of February. They've just appeared, just lights up. It goes out. As it's going out, another one appears, but you can still see the two of them. And as that one's going out, another one appears, and then they all go out. I don't know, period of 10 minutes, 15 minutes, another two will appear. And that's the nature of how it is, you know. And we were making the best of our time on the cliff tops. Jerry, the lighting and sound engineer, was looking at these things, and Chris Turner, they would never seen anything like them. We've got qualified people up there, and you sort of all fairly level-headed. So the six of us observing these lights. And over a two-hour period, Howard, these things were appearing at random in ones, twos and threes out at sea, totally silent. Now, we checked shipping radar, civilian aircraft data, weather and barometer readings, everything, wind direction, wind strength, atmospheric temperature, with Lee Haywood to thank for this. I mean, the guy looks at things inside out, and we've got Jerry's technical ability at looking at lights. I mean, he was measuring and looking at these lights and the colour temperature in Kelvin, estimating that they looked about 2000 Kelvin. I mean, and basically what I'm trying to stress is we were six people up there not getting blown away by the sight of a Chinese lantern or a satellite flashing through, slowly moving through the sky and thinking that we've seen an alien spacecraft.
Well, I don't think a Chinese lantern would put out a consistent 2000 Kelvin. That's bright. No. That's like a lighthouse, isn't it?
And here's another interesting feature, which I'm sure all five guys would echo. They don't light up the area around them. They're intense. And this is something I've spoke to Coast Guard off the record and lifeboat men, whenever we meet. When they've said it's unusual when we get the glasses on and when we get binoculars on, and we can't tell how far out these things are because basically, they're not lighting up the area like a flare would do, and you're not seeing a trail of smoke, and you're not seeing a slow descent on the wind. You're not seeing any of that. They just appear, hang there for a while, and then switch off, and then appear in a different part of the sky. It's almost like they're playing with us, Howard. It's a very strange.
Do you think you'll ever be able to get to the bottom of this? Because you keep seeing weird behavior by these lights. And people, just like the farmers with the sheep mutilations and the animal mutilations generally, people quietly accept them as a phenomenon of the locality, of something that is part of their lives. Ditto with the lights. People know this is going on. The local people who go out to sea to fish know all about this because some of these things go out to sea. But nobody is able to explain it.
No, and it almost seems blasé in the explanations what the Coast Guard put out and the lifeboat put out for their lengthy call-outs involving multiple lifeboats from all different agencies. And at the end of the night, I mean, not on all cases, because obviously there's some genuine urgent calls requiring lifeboats to go out due to flares, but they know what they are. But these lights, obviously, there's something so real that people have gone out, but they just get put down as a false alarm with good intent. And I've said it before, I don't think there's any conspiracy here, and I think that both agencies are absolutely fabulous. But what we're dealing with, Howard, is something that's existence is denied. So what more can they do? Until people accept that this phenomena exists, even if we don't understand what it is, there's the sticking point, that science wants to understand it before it will accept it. In my opinion, that seems to be what's happening. Or doesn't want to accept it. It doesn't exist because it can't possibly exist. So its existence is denied.
Its existence is denied, but it keeps happening.
it keeps happening, and there, and lots of people keep seeing them. These reports, they didn't start when I started investigating this. These reports go back to when, to the time when lifeboat logs were created, and you know, and Coast Guard logs were created. They're there, the call outs to suspected ships in distress and aircraft in distress.
And when you've asked, when you've been doing your research, when you've asked perhaps people who are connected with or part of the military, because there's a big military presence there, we know that, various bases, including Bempton itself in the past. When you've asked those questions about whether this is military technology, what kind of response do you get?
Well, the military people I've spoke to, when I've shown them the clips of footage that I've taken, and I've been up on the clifftops with the various ex-military people who've seen these things, they haven't a clue. I dare say, though, that there's people within the military that do have knowledge of what's happening. I mean, we have had these unusual military vehicles up on the clifftops throughout 2017, 18, and I think they were at Aldbury in 2019. The American Ram pickups with, I think they got German number plates with the huge dish on the top.
Yeah, we talked about that before. Some very strange American vehicles with strange number plates. Something's going on. Now, look, we've got to go through some new and current cases here, some new stuff. And then in the next segment, after the next lot of commercials, we'll get to some questions. So we're going to have to go through this fairly quick. But a recent cryptid sighting. A man and a woman on the clifftops at Flamborough Head, end of January this year. What exactly was this then? What were you told?
It's interesting, Howard, in that it's a year and 7 days between the cryptid sighting by the paratroopers on the clifftops on February. Now, this was 31st of January 2020, and forgive me if I'm going a bit faster, but if you want to get this in, we'll have to do. And these couple, Jamie and Lee, that's the real names, they've told me I can use the names. I've spoke to them today, actually. And they hired a cottage for the weekend at Flamborough. And they came fairly late and parked the car up and walked down from the cottage to North Landing Car Park to have a look at the sea. Once there's some earth steps that have been cut out into the bank, and they go down into a little ravine. The ravine is called Holmes's Gut. You'll not find it on a map. That's the Flamborough terminology, which is interesting. Holmes's Gut. It's a bit of a strange name, but there you go. The cliffs there are about 80 to 100 feet. And they got in the bottom. They stood on a small wooden bridge. They could hear the stream running and said it felt a bit creepy. They'd not come looking for unexplained phenomena. They didn't know me. So they walked back up to the top and they stood observing, looking out to sea. Now, the outcrops of rock that stick out to sea, the ones that have survived the sort of tides and everything else over the years, they jut out to sea probably, I don't know, 50 to 60 foot, and they're about 30 foot wide with just 100 foot cliffs in between. They're called nabs, and they're on Bartlett's Nab and various nabs. Well, anyway, they're looking out to sea, and it's a moonlit night, and they observe a dog sat on the edge of the cliff. They can see it in the moonlight. Now, they thought it was a carving or a statue. They'd not seen it previous when they first came, and it's night time, remember, it's 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, moonlit night. They can see the cliffs, they can see the white of the cliffs and the outline of this thing, and they're just puzzled. They can't understand what they're looking at. These are two professional people. They've got a night vision camera. What do they call it? Infrared camera with no card in it, but it enabled them to look. They've got a JVC 4K camera and a DSLR, and they looked at this thing through the cameras and couldn't see it, not even in the infrared camera. Now, this is what they've told me. So they said they couldn't understand what they're looking at, and they heard a guttural growl, and this thing then moved and dropped to all fours. And these nabs are cambered. They're on an arc, like top of your head, sort of slopes down, and it went to the other side of the arc. And they could see its back slinking along. With this, they panicked. They said their heads were on swivels, and they walked back to the cottage. They talked about it, they discussed it, and then they got back in the car and they went back up to the car park with the lights on full beam, and then sort of ventured out with torches, and there's nothing there. They contacted me between at 11:30 and 12:30 that same night. They'd been looking online or probably on the tablets or whatever to look for anything unusual. And me and Bob Brown met them the following day. So that's their story. And what they said, this thing.
How big was it?
This interesting thing. The guy, Lee, said, I'm 6 foot tall. Well, I asked him, I said, how tall are you? He said, about 6 foot. He said it was as tall as him sat on the edge of the cliffs. And they both said, I mean, I've not watched this, so some people will know what I mean. They said its arms were that unusual. They were too long. And they said, have you ever seen the skaters on the film or the musical Starlight Express with the roller skates on their hands? Don't ask me what that means. I've not looked at it, but they said their arms are, what this thing's arms, and they were calling them arms, were too long. Now, listeners, you've only got my word and the word of these people. Now, they seemed sincere. They were very shook up. It took them hours to drive home. They said all they talked about on the journey home was this sighting. Now,
so that remains as yet unexplained. We don't know what that was.
Totally unexplained. And I find it interesting that February the 7th, 2019, so a year and 7 days between, we have a paratrooper sighting, on the clifftops, less than 2 miles away. Just what are we dealing with? I mean, I don't subscribe to the idea that we've got something flesh and blood roaming.
Well, if it's not registering with an infrared camera, it must be whatever it is, something else. The only other alternative is that these people are mistaken, and they've given you so much detail, how could they be? I want to move on to this one quickly then, Paul, if we can. Then I'm going to get to listener questions in the final segment, if that's okay. This was something that vanished in front of a beach angler's eyes at Hornsey.
Oh, fabulous sighting. Yeah, this young guy was fishing at Hornsey. The time, he looked at his watch and he'd moved off the beach because the sea conditions were absolutely terrible. The sea was roaring. And he tucked himself behind the small harbour wall, the small sea defence, and it was approximately 12:10 at night. And he's looking down the beach and he sees a figure walking along the shoreline. And he'd just moved off it because it weren't even high tide. It was an hour before high tide and the sea was so far up. He said the figure was very, very small and slim, approximately 5 foot tall. He said if it was human, it had to be a woman because of the sort of slim structure of it, but it was so small. Now, he's watching it and puzzled by what he's looking at, and I don't know whether it was cramp or whether he wanted to just show this thing that it was there, but he stood up. Now, when he stood up, this thing stopped instantly. In its tracks, he says, I got the feeling it thought, oh, my God, I've been seen. I think he probably thought someone else swore as well, but we've no need to do that. He said it was completely black from head to toe, as though his face was black as well. He felt, because it wasn't that far away when he stood up, that he should have been able to see some kind of, I don't know, some kind of shading or something on its face, but it was as though it was in a black suit completely. As he's watching it over a period of 5 to 7 seconds, this thing, and this young guy's words were, it sort of pixelated and vanished. Now, he was terrified, absolutely frightened to death.
Pixelated, so it didn't just disappear. It went like the Star Trek, what's that thing, the Star Trek, beam me up, Scotty.
No, he said it just slowly broke up and disappeared in front of his eyes.
How
I
weird.
Don't mean broke up and floated away. Now, he called his dad right away, so we can't have been much, not much after the 12:10. And he called his dad, and he's looking around all the time, and he's packing his things away, and he says he's 5 minutes from home. His dad arrived, so if we were generous and said it was a 15-minute journey between picking him up, because he said he came straight away, told his dad what had happened, between picking him up and dropping him off, we're talking 15 minutes. He arrived home, and when he got in the kitchen, it was 1:37. Now, we can't understand that.
So there was a time anomaly. Now, there's another anomaly here, and this is good because we can take some commercials here. We've lost the line, and we have the curse of 22 the hour. We've talked about this every week. We have a digital dropout, something to do with whatever's going on here, and everything dies at 22 the hour. So we're going to call Paul back. More from Paul Sinclair in just a moment here on The Unexplained. Stay with us. Paul, listen, we're very tight for time here, so we're going to have to get through. This is my fault, not yours. Don't worry. We've had one of those nights. But but we're getting there, and you're always fantastic, so thank you. I've got about six listener questions, so we're going to have to do them fairly sharpish. So let's get the first one done here. Duncan in Florida. Duncan, thank you for this. Basically says, do you detect any similarities between the stuff that you are detecting there and what's been going on, we read, at the Skinwalker Ranch in the USA?
I think the answer to that is yes. I think the Skinwalker connections, Howard, or Duncan, should I say, are self-evident. You know, the fact that other people are seeing the similarities speaks volumes. You know, like Skinwalker, like Bempton and the surrounding area, they present all manner of unexplained phenomena. And Skinwalker and these areas around East Yorkshire leave a person feeling like they're being observed and like they're being played with. So in answer to that, yes.
Including the balls of light. How strange. Yes. And I'm sure that there will be more to talk about, you know, those connections. Philip in Kyoto, Japan, who I know is listening right now, he says something that you said somewhere that he monitored. Maybe it was one of our podcasts. You said that you were going back to an area to investigate with a metal detector where he thought the shot landed. I wonder if you could ask him, that's Paul, more about that, and if he discovered anything relating to the incident. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It does make sense, Howard. I didn't think we'd ever spoke about this when you just read that then. Somebody shot at me last year on the cliff tops, a bullet. It weren't a pellet gun or anything. And the police were involved. And I have been back to area, and myself and Chris Turner and Jerry, we did some filming and talked about it. And I've been back searching. I knew where this shot was. I sort of marked, or didn't mark with a pencil or anything, but I've sort of marked the location, and I've been back trying to find the bullet. And basically, yeah, I've been back and I've tried, but I've not got no further with the police. It was a genuine crime as such. The police have looked into it.
If you're sure that was a gunshot.
Oh, it was. It was. You know, my dad used to have a firearms license, and I've been around guns city that passed my chest.
And you've been looking for the shell, and you can't find it.
Can't find it.
Well, you know, keep us posted on that. That's really scary, Paul. Are you not worried about that sort of thing?
I am, yeah. At first, I did. They were cutting the crops further up at Speeton, about a mile and a half away, and I did wonder if. I don't know, even though it were daytime, a lovely sunny day, I did wonder if a farmer had shot at a deer or a rabbit. I was actually up there getting daylight shots for the police officer, daylight shots, photographs, for the police officer who saw the red figure of eight phenomena on the cliff tops at Speeton. And I said I'd go up and get some daylight photographs for him. And it was walking back that the gunshot occurred.
Well, that is very, very worrying. And it may have been, as you say, an accident. It may have been something that just happened on a farm. But too close for comfort. Keep us posted on that. Jason asks this. Could you reveal anything else about the case of the men working at the industrial unit in Hummondby? Poltergeist-like activity, UFO landing. What's that all about?
I think the Hunnamby landing is probably my favourite case, and I've not moved that much further on it. It's in a kind of limbo at the moment. I've thrown out lots of hooks via social media and talking to local people in Hunnamby. And I don't know if we spoke about this once before on the radio, Howard. And it's just the nature of the subject matter. They're reluctant to talk, but basically in 1998, I think it was in August, a UFO landed at the back, in the ground at the back of an industrial unit at Hummondby here in East Yorkshire, witnessed by three independent witnesses who have spoken face to face with all three, and they're all singing off the same sheet. One of them, I do know, knows more than the others, and that's part of the reason that the story has not gone much further, but it will.
When you say UFO, is this like a disc-shaped craft or something else?
According to Andy, who first put me onto this, and what's interesting here, Howard, is that this guy, Andy, has been a friend of mine for 20-odd years, 28 years, and his son used to work for me, and he's never mentioned it. Never mentioned it in all that time because he didn't want to talk about it. He spoke about it to someone else who was a mutual friend, and this ex-military guy, Jim, said, you must tell Paul Sinclair, and that let the cat out of the bag. And I went up and spoke to him and sat down. He allowed me to record him. And from him, I got to the other witness. And from him, I got to the third one. And when I say got to, it sounds a bit harsh, that, but got to speak to them. And that all three have never met in the last 10 years, really. They've had no association with each other, and they're all telling the same thing.
Did they report it? At the time, I think the MOD was still collating reports. Have they reported that?
No, and the military were involved. The military knew all about it. These guys, because he says it was, in Andrew's words, it was a classic flying saucer that they were looking at with a glass dome on the top and a figure in it. He thought it was some kind of film set. He couldn't believe what he were looking at.
Well, it's not exactly about, I don't know where you would expect these things to happen, but you hear about these things happening in Arizona, not Unmundi. That's weird. And you're not much further on with it, but you're looking for new information though all the time.
New information, and it's difficult. We're going back to 1998. We know military roadblocks were set up. We know because one of the lads, Dave, his mum and dad were stopped and taken into the back of a military vehicle and interrogated. And because he was the youngest of the guys that worked at the unit, and his mum and dad used to come, because these guys had 8 9-to-5 jobs, should I say, and on a night they went and worked on this unit. So they'd work from 6 o'clock till 12 in the evening, sometimes till 2 in the morning at the weekends. And the I-class spray jobs and doing fairground rides, that was the nature of what they were doing. And this young lad, the youngest of them, his mum and dad used to come through, probably took sandwiches and took drinks and spent some time with the son. They probably didn't see enough of him. So we know the military roadblocks were set up. Now, I've thrown these questions out on various forums and various people in Humanby. Sooner or later, I'm sure somebody's going to step forward and say, I remember this. And we'll just get a little bit further with it. It's a long process. It's sat there since 1998. And I'm willing to sit on it for another 10 years. I'm sure that information will come.
There's a whole book in that. Bill in Swindon asks whether the cattle mutilations or the sheep mutilations and other creatures being mutilated, have you made any Freedom of Information requests of DEFRA, the Environment Department?
No, I haven't. I mean, I spoke to Linda Moulton Howe, not about DEFRA, but about that and various things. I mean, she were asking me if we'd got veterinary people involved and things. And I have tried to get vets involved. I've showed them the photographs, but nobody wants to tackle it. Because you can see the nature of, and the extent of the injuries does not conform to what we'd expect.
And I mean, it's so hard to explain. You know, if it's poachers, then you can see they're doing it for meat and the meat will go. But that's not the way, as you said, it's not the way it happens. Archie asks, have you thought about using, and I think you have used these from past conversations, but have you thought about using motion sensing cameras?
We've set motion sensing cameras up, yes, and we've not had any luck with them. You know, we've got quite expensive night vision gear. We've tried infrared. We've thrown everything at it. We've had very high Geiger counter readings on one of the deer carcasses, but I've not had the same readings on the sheep carcasses. Why that is, I don't know, because you would expect if there was any radiation present or...
Well, it would be consistent.
Yeah, you would, yeah. But I'm not going to lie, and I haven't had that on the sheep carcass.
Ian, one of my regulars, Ian Watson, he asks, and it's not really, it's more of a statement really than an ask, but it's something that I would ask too, or rather state, that Ian says, on balance, I believe that crypto sightings, UFOs and some other supernatural phenomena have an interdimensional aspect to them. Now, you and I have talked around this before. In other words, maybe we're seeing things or experiencing things that pop in and out of perhaps a parallel universe or another dimension.
Without a doubt. We've got to jump off the fence with our beliefs at some point. And, you know, and if I were going to say where I thought I was with this, I would think the interdimensional aspect of this, regardless of what people want to believe, is where it's happening. It's almost as though these things are looking at us through a two-way mirror, like in an interrogation room, and they can literally just step in and out of our existence because they're not leaving anything behind. They're not they're leaving the decimation of the mutilated animals, if that's what's responsible. But they're not leaving it. The only thing that they leave are the images of, imprinted in people's minds, and we can't take them out as proof. Mm. Howard, the evidence is absolutely overwhelming, but the proof is nil.
And that is going to be the dilemma through all of this research, which is ongoing and continues. Robin in America basically says some of these things you're talking about, the mutilations in particular, are very similar to stuff as we know that's been going on in the United States. You mentioned Linda Moulton Howe, who is probably the leading researcher of these things over there. It's not just happening here, it's happening there and in other countries.
That's true. I at the Awakening Conference, not last year, the year before, Linda Moulton Howe requested an hour-long face-to-face with me, and she was telling me about the cases that she'd worked on, and she actually wanted to stay in the UK and come and do a bit of work with me at Bempton, it's a nice thought, but these people are so reluctant to talk. Mm. They just wouldn't have. She'd have had to stay quite a long time.
You need to be a bit further on.
It's global. Howard, it's global. Yeah, it's not just happening here in the UK. It's America. I would think every country in the world.
But the question is, what is behind it? Now, look, you're working on a documentary, and because you are, as I said, prolific, you're working on a documentary and a couple of new books. Talk to me about those.
The documentary is called The Superliminal. And that is a real word, and it means to exist above the realms of consciousness. And we're just interviewing people. It'll be same as bringing down the light. We're going to just feature new cases, because everything I see in the UFO and the paranormal field, or not everything, but a lot of things, are just repetitive things with someone else's slant on them. So we've got fresh new cases and stories that people have never heard before. I'm working on a truth proof I have enough information for that book. But before that, I must get the book about my own experiences finished, which is called The Night People. And I will get that done first. And that The Night People is probably why I'm so driven today. The reason I'm never switch off from this subject.
And those experiences are what you might call, you know, for want of another phrase, alien contact.
Yeah, if we're going to call them aliens, I struggle to understand what they are that I saw as a child and what has sort of followed me from childhood. I think the last sort of serious intervention probably were 1998, but there's been things happening over the years that have been unexplained after that. But it's such a difficult thing, Howard. But you've got to say, why deny what your own mind and your own eyes have seen? Unless people think you're nuts, then that's so be it. But when you've actually seen beings that should not exist, it just throws your head in a different place. You think different. It doesn't make you a better person. It doesn't make you more intelligent. It's just that you've seen it.
And you have to be, as you said, you've got to be true to yourself, which you are. You are the most diligent researcher that I've ever known. You're very easy to talk with. And I didn't give you enough time tonight. Let's do 2 hours next time, and let's do some more podcasts, if you can fit any of that in with the international demand for your services, Paul.
You've always had time for me, and you know for a fact I'll fit it in.
Well, I'm delighted that it's all going so well and fascinated by everything that you do. What's your website so people can go and see you online?
It's truthproof.webs.com, and I think I say it every time, I'm useless with social media. If we go to Facebook, there's a Truth Proof page. Anybody who wants to find me on there, if you've got a story to tell, if you want to ask me a question, I'm approachable. Treat me with respect, and I treat everybody I speak to in the same manner. So
you absolutely do. Hey, Paul, thank you for staying up to do this. Thank you very much. Take care. Good night.
Thank you.
Paul Sinclair. The books are called Truth Proof. There's more in the works, as you heard. Ted, thank you very much for telling me about what it's like to walk around Flamborough near the lighthouse and how spooky that is. Thank you for that.
The remarkable Paul Sinclair, one of the best researchers in any field that I know. He'll be returning to the podcast very soon. But that was Paul from my radio show last Sunday, the 8th of March, and I thought you'd like to hear this. The next scheduled edition of The Unexplained is edition 435, coming soon, so look out for that. And if you're hearing this across the weekend, please try not to worry too much about life and everything, and please stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.